Auris Noster recollat, sancti viri festum. Let our choir celebrate the feast of holy men. When we think of Irish music, we tend to think of traditional folk music. Or maybe we think of the Baroque-influenced music of O'Carolan. Or perhaps we imagine the music that once echoed in the halls of the High Kings. But the earliest notated music in Ireland, that's music where the melody is recorded in written form, is none of these. The first music to be transcribed in Ireland was the elegantly austere Latin chant of the monasteries. The process of devising a form of music notation in Europe, we might say of creating a musical alphabet in order to write and thereby record music, began in the early Middle Ages, and it grew out of Charlemagne's efforts in the 9th century to standardise the forms of Christian ritual throughout the Western world. Clerical scribes began devising methods to notate plain chant, what we now know as Gregorian chant, so that the same chants could be used throughout the church. The process of notation developed over centuries as the music itself developed and became increasingly more complex. The beginnings of writing music in Ireland more or less coincide with the time of the Anglo-Norman invasion of the 12th century, so it's not surprising that most of the music recorded in the Irish monasteries was of Anglo-Norman origin. Sadly, we can only guess at the sound of very early monastic chant in Ireland because there's no written record of the music from those times. But as we'll see, it's possible to find traces and clues to what might have been an older, more indigenous Celtic ritual from the very early centuries of Christian life in Ireland and before the uniformity imposed by Charlemagne. But let's first explore some of the medieval chant that was transcribed in the company of a group designed for that very purpose. We're listening to the choral group Cantarelle and a chant dedicated to St. Killian from a 16th century manuscript. I first became aware of Cantarelle while recording a Kyrie eleison I had composed with the choral group Shiona. They happened to mention that they were an offshoot of a larger group, Cantarelle, whose chief focus was medieval Irish monastic chant. I was intrigued and began a journey of discovery into this unique aspect of our heritage. The Drummond Missal from the 12th century is our earliest source of notated chant in Ireland. It's currently housed in the Pierpont Morgan Museum in New York. But before we go any further, perhaps we should pause to consider what's understood by that word chant. Composer, musician and teacher, the late Mihalo Sulivorn had a lifelong interest in the expressive powers of chant and its potential for future composition.
We think of it initially, when we think of chant, we think of Christian chant, and we think of particularly of the chant that has come down through the Christian church. But it has a wider context across other cultures. The notion of chanting, the notion of intoning, the notion of heightened speech, the connection between what they say in Greek writing, you know, when heroes sing, that suddenly you begin to get an inspired form of language. And it's when language heightens into poetry and heightens further from that again, it can burst into a particular kind of song. And the particular kind of song, because it has come out of language, is very linked to language rhythms, but very, very linked to language rhythms. So in that sense, the notion of chanting something. So, you know, even today now we'd say, oh, I was listening to an early recording of W.B. Yeats and he's chanting his poetry, which he liked to do. And indeed, even when poets read their poetry, sometimes there's a chanting element to it. What does that mean? To some degree, it means that as I'm speaking to you now, what characterises speech means that there isn't any fixed pitch at all after moving on to a fixed pitch suddenly. Now, that's like kind of unnatural. It's not like the obliteration in a way of accent, but it's the notion of a fixed pitch. That the minute I move on to a fixed pitch and I start to talk like that, something has happened. What has actually happened there? Because I don't think any language anywhere at any time probably stayed on a fixed pitch like that all the time or for a long period of time. There's a connection between chanting and, I think, the spirit, the raising off the ground, the feeling of being groundless, the feeling of a non-gravitational element, the feeling of moving towards the heavens instead of towards the earth.
Monasteries and the monastic life were an integral part of Christianity in Ireland from the very beginning. Historian Colmán O'Clubby.
We have references to the monks and nuns amongst the converts to Christianity made by St. Patrick in his confession, which is the earliest Christian document to survive from Ireland. And throughout the early Middle Ages, monasteries, monastic sites, however you interpret that term, played a key role in the cultural, the intellectual, and indeed sometimes the political life of early medieval Ireland, as they would indeed in the later Middle Ages as well.
And from the very beginning, the life of a monk revolved around a daily cycle of work, study, and prayer, including those public acts of worship, such as Vespers in the evening, known as the Liturgy of the Hours or the Divine Office.
There would have been constants with regard to the round and cycle of prayer that would punctuate the monastic day, and the way in which the liturgical seasons marked the various feasts and fasts of the Christian calendar. So I think fundamentally at the core of the monastic life for male and female monastics, you have this commitment to the divine office, to the liturgy of the hours that punctuate the day, starting early in the morning, working through to just after sunset.
Chant was a central component in the prayer life of a monk or nun. It's a form of communal prayer in which the slow, stately movement allows the human voice to imbue the words with an additional resonance and depth.
It's the opposite to the earth-affirming gesture of dance music. And indeed, the Irish situation is very good there, isn't it? Because, you know, when you see Irish trad musicians, as we call them, traditional musicians playing, there's an awful lot of foot tapping. And the thing is metrical regularity. So that's the opposite the chant. So you, after you have that dong, the regularity is not chant. But suddenly when you pull that regularity out, something extraordinary happens. You now have to look for and listen for a new form of logic, which cuts, in my opinion, to the very heart of rhythm itself, which is made up of the ratio of durations. So we think of rhythm as da 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 rhythm. But duration is da, or here's a longer duration, da, or here's a shorter duration, da, and here's that repeated, da, da. Here's two shorter durations with a slightly longer duration, da, da, da. Here's that repeated, da, 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 rhythm. But when you strip back rhythm and you go back into duration itself, and when the logic of the music comes from actual raw material of the duration of the notes, I think that's where you get a feeling of not foot tapping, which is saying yes, yes all the time to life and to dance and to the earth. And it's affirming that. But you couldn't, you would be inconceivable to be tapping your foot during playing chant. You know, I can't imagine how somebody would manage that and yet get the right sound. What do you do with your body when you're singing chant? What do chanters do with their body? You know, something extraordinary happens. It's, you know, different people will have different ways of expressing that. But for me, the feeling is very, very strongly one of being raised off the ground. Now, chanting in many cultures is linked to spirituality and therefore is linked to different religious traditions. Right across Asia, South America, everywhere. So there's some connection between what we're talking about here, about that sense of weightlessness and that kind of angelic, if you wish, not to be utopian about it, moving towards the heavens into that particular side of the equation, because we live between the earth and the heavens, and moving out of the gravitational pull of the earth up towards the heavens, which creates that particular gesture, sonic gesture, which seems to work for us as human beings in evoking something of the other and of the spirit.
This is part of a mass from a Roman manuscript dated 1071, but the chant itself is centuries older and may indicate how pre-Norman chant could have sounded in Ireland. Interest in chant ran so deep that, together with Helen Phelan, both of them then based in the Irish World Academy of Music and Dance in Limerick, which Mihol had founded, it was decided to set up a chant group under the direction of Catherine Sargon in order to explore the Irish material discovered in the early manuscripts and to give this material a new life in performance. Helen Phelan.
One of the early inspirations for having a chant programme in the University of Limerick, lots of people say, why is there a chant programme in a vernacular university, was our connection with the Benedictine community at Glenstall Abbey. Glenstall Abbey is located about 10 miles from the University of Limerick, and it's one of the few monastic communities in Ireland that still sings in Latin the liturgical round of offices every day. So we thought this was a really wonderful opportunity. One of the things we feel very passionately about here at the Irish World Academy is this connection between our musical sources. So whether they're manuscript sources or the living tradition, and actually performing those, bringing those to life. So this connection between performance and scholarship is really important to us. And we had this idea that if we could form a collective and bring together the expertise of singers, historians, musicologists, people who were specialists in paleography, you know, reading manuscripts and neumes, if we could bring that expertise together, which we had here with our tutors, our faculty, our doctoral students, and we could focus on the manuscript tradition of Ireland, some material that really has never been recorded, is very rarely sung anymore, and yet is sitting in libraries in Ireland and in continental Europe and in England and Scotland. If we could bring that expertise together to unearth this material and to sing it.
And so the choral group Cantorale was formed in 2008 with a primary focus on material from Ireland or related to Ireland that links into that medieval heritage.
Sometimes when people talk about Irish music, they forget that this very, very early layer of Latin chant is the earliest example of notated music that we have in Ireland and a really, really important part of our cultural heritage.
Catherine Sargeon is the artistic director of the group Cantorale.
The act of singing together is to worship together. I mean, it makes a community in one, you know, if I can say that. And the more harmonious the sound will be together, the better what we express for the worship.
Albis Clerici is a chant dedicated to St. Bridget from a 15th century manuscript now housed in Trinity College, Dublin. It reflects a major feature of early Irish Christianity, the veneration of the saints, whose lives were used as the models for a perfect Christian life. Their biographies were known as hagiographies, holy writings.
The hagiographies that are associated with the early saints, whether it be figures like St. Patrick or the life of St. Bridget by Cogitosis, or particularly the life of St. Columba by Athelfnan, his successor as Abbot of Iona, prove very influential as templates which will allow the hagiographies of other saints to be composed. And in turn, these early Irish hagiographies draw on the great continental models, the lives, for instance, of St. Martin of Tours or of St. Antony of Egypt, provide very influential in shaping how the character of a saint is presented in early Ireland.
And in addition to those influences from what's now modern-day France and the Middle East, there was also the influence of pre-Christian Irish traditions.
One of the things that I find really interesting when we look at the manuscript evidence in early Irish monasticism is this very easy coexistence of pre-Christian and Christian material. So we find in Irish monasticism the teaching of Latin, of rhetoric, but also a great respect for the lore of the Fili, for Irish language, literature and poetry. And this, what's really fascinating to me when I look at the chant repertoire, is that this co-mingling survives right up to the late medieval period. One of the places we find this in particular are the saints' offices. If we look at an office like the office to St. Bridget, we can see evidence of how these two traditions talk to each other. There's a wonderful reading in the office, for example, about the birth of Bridget. And in the reading, and this is a liturgical office, in the reading it tells a story how Bridget's mother, she was stepping over the threshold. She had one foot inside and one foot outside the threshold, so a very liminal moment. And she stumbles. And she's carrying a jug of milk, which she drops. And in stumbling and dropping the milk, she gives birth to Bridget. It's a painless birth, we're told. But also, as she's giving birth to Bridget, the milk washes over the baby and purifies the baby. Now, there are very strong resonance in that to the tradition of Imbolc, which of course is the feast of St. Bridget, but it's a much older pre-Christian. It's a feast around lactation, around the birthing of youths, about the beginnings of life. That's followed then with a responsory about the baptism of Bridget. And in that responsory, we're told the priests, the clergy, who were all dressed in white, baptize Bridget with water and then clothe her in white. So we have this purification with milk, this pre-Christian purification, the purification with water, the Christian baptism, but the clothing in white in both of the stories of Bridget, the sign of purification. And of course, the Feast of St. Bridget is followed on the 2nd of February by Candlemas, also the Feast of the Presentation of Jesus and the Purification of Mary. The pre-Christian Bridget goddess is the daughter of Dagda. And Dagda is the fire god, the blacksmith god. And of course, Bridget's often associated with blacksmithing as well. So there's a very strong connection there. And there's a lovely, again, a reading in one of the offices to Bridget, where Bridget is in the baby Bridget is in the house, and her stepfather goes out to look at the stars. And as he's looking at the stars, the house blazes up on fire. And he sees the fire shooting up, showing where the child Bridget is. And again, there's a beautiful responsory in that same office, which talks about Bridget blazing like a star in the firmaments of heaven. And the bishops, the clergy, declare her another Mary. And that's a very important honorific title for Bridget, Mary of the Gaels.
So
terms of transcribed chant, we're talking very roughly about the last 1,000 years where chant interacts with music literacy.
It's obviously starting with neumes and then developing into the four-line stave and whatever it might happen to be. So the memory, the oral memory of the chanter is assisted by, in some way, by some notational devices that help you to either remember the various chants and then to sing them, as we would say now, by ear, or to actually follow them in with your eye as well as with your ear. But what about the first 1,000 years?
This, of course, is one of the great unanswerable questions, but it's an appealing one that invites speculation. What might have been the sound of an ancient Celtic rite before the arrival of the Normans and before Charlemagne's efforts to standardise the forms of prayer?
It may have had elements in performance which would be quite a surprise if we were able to travel back in a time-space capsule or something to actually drop into around the 6th century and hear what was going on Skellig Michael or in Iona or in Clonmacnoise. I mean, what was the sound that was coming out? I find it very hard to believe that it was even remotely like Salem. You know, to what degree it was in any way like what has emerged in secular performances, where it has been decontextualized from the liturgy over the past, say, 30, 40 years with professional early music singers. Whether that is nearer, I'd say it's nearer, but I would, this is pure gut instinct here now, no evidence whatsoever of any scientific nature. I would still think that the sound is very cleaned up and that the ensemble is reflecting an aesthetic of good ensemble that you would think of in, an orchestra over the last, couple of 100 years. Whereas when we have a listen to strange things like Coptic, not strange at all, of course, what they sound strange when we listen to them first, Coptic chant, Coptic Christian chant.
Given the strong monastic emphasis of early Christianity in Ireland, which invites comparisons with the early Coptic Church and the Desert Fathers of Egypt, and given the Middle Eastern influence on the templates for the lives of the saints that we've already seen, it's no great leap to imagine that this ancient chant by monks of the Coptic Church may bear some similarity with the sound of very early Christian chant in Ireland. Another possible clue may lie in the sound of the psalms as they emerged in the reformist church of the Gaelic-speaking islands of the Hebrides. Its untamed abandon stands in marked contrast to the ordered structure of Gregorian chant. Donald MacLeod and congregation performing verses from Psalm 46 from a recording made in Stornoway Free Church on the Isle of Lewis in June 1969, and which to me always brings to mind the almost primordial sound of the keen. Might the keen also carry an echo of early Irish monastic chant?
The word keen, which we will find now in the English language as a fully marketed term, it's in the Oxford Dictionary. K-E-E-N, comes from an Irish Gaelic word, Cuine, C-A-O-I-N-E, in the modern spelling, which to some degree, keening, or a cuine, as we'd say in Irish, is a form of a cry, sometimes called in English the Irish cry. And of course, it was music of lamentation. So it came down even into the 19th century, into tiny little fragments of it into the 20th century. And we know that over the last few centuries before that, it had been in the employ of professional female lamentation singers that one would hire for the funeral of a lost one. Totally non-Christian or pre-Christian, whichever you want to put it. Completely, the few texts that have survived are not bursting with references to God or Mary or anything like that. There's obviously Christian versions of stuff related to it. For example, there are religious songs in the Christian tradition in Irish that have got to do with the Cuine, the lament of Mary for her son Jesus. Or the lament of the three Marys at the foot of the cross, Queen and the Drie Vuide. So there's a wonderful example of the pre-Christian Cuine mingling with the Christian text and the Christian Bible story. But there are elements. So is there something in the Cuine? What's interesting is that the attempts in the 18th and 19th century to write down the Cuine, or to write down the Cuine, by people who had music notation, visitors in a way to the culture, who heard it, are collectors like Edward Bunting, George Petrie, various people like that. They attempted on a very few occasions, not wildly a huge amount, they attempted to write it down, and it's literally a mess on the page. You can't make sense of it because there aren't identifiable melodic lines. It's not memorable as it is on the page. This is plainly improvised oral tradition music that was never written down, never intended to be written down, and musical literacy is irrelevant to it. So the very fact that they had difficulty writing down meant that it was really celebrating in the way its orality. So it is the kind of thing you'd find in many oral tradition cultures throughout Asia and other places, where the singer throws back his or her head and emits a cry out of the body itself, which is over and above the culture from which it comes. You know, it is the cry, to some degree, of the newborn child. You know, it is the result of the first breath. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. This is primal stuff, you know. And should we be surprised if it sends a shiver up the spine?
Kitty Gallagher singing A Cuine, recorded in Gweedore in Donegal in 1952. Of course, there are also very early Irish church manuscripts that date from well before the time that notation was developed, and which give us just the words of the prayers and songs. Might evidence of a uniquely Celtic rite be found there? Anne Mannion is a musicologist specialising in medieval liturgical chant.
And we can say, like, we have traces, we can find traces. And as we know, in the 9th century, there was this total reform of the church in the 9th century by Charlemagne, by his sons. And of course, this would, this like suppressing local traditions. This was the impetus from Rome to have a central authority to standardise. So that would then have really affected local and regional practices. And as we know, like, there was no central authority in Ireland anyway. I mean, you have tribes, you have different kingdoms in different places. So there's no such thing as a unified church even in Ireland in that sense. So we did look then at the source of what has survived. One of the early sources we have, of course, is the Antiphonary of Bangor, a very valuable source for us. And in that, even though it gives us an idea of the early office in the medieval Irish church. So you have the Antiphonary itself from the 7th century. It contains then hymns, collects and prayers. And what was sort of unique to the Irish church would be the use of hymns, and that they used hymns in a liturgical way that wasn't maybe used in Rome. This kind of sets us a little bit apart from the other rites.
And what's different about these hymns is a fusion of the Latin with indigenous poetry forms, short lines with assonance and alliteration and rhyming verse, similar in style to the most ancient of Irish poems. And while this approach was common in the Eastern Church, it wasn't common in the West.
In the West, the material that we find in liturgical sources is more prose-based. But we have a lot of rhymed metrical verse in the Irish. Now, you could speculate and say that there's a connection, but also the tradition of metrical verse is very strong in Ireland, even in pre-Christian material. And this continues right on into the bardic tradition. So that's an interesting, I think, unique characteristic of Irish manuscript tradition.
There was a lot of communication between the Irish church and the continent. Like, the Irish are the great wanderers of the Middle Ages. Like, Wallifred Strabo describes them as that race which above any other loves to wander. I think it's something that remains in the Irish character to the present. The Irish, in many ways, are the first great missionaries of Christianity, the first ones to hear the gospel message outside the confines of the Roman Empire. And they take it to themselves, and it sort of bears a very rich but very different fruit in the Irish context. And this urges them, this idea of you know, coming in and going out, urges them to take that message to other parts of the world. So you find them in Iceland, you may even have found them in Greenland. You find Irish saints and missionaries operating all over Britain, France, Italy. When you think of someone like Columbanus as the one of the patrons of Europe, in many ways one of the inventors of Europe as a concept, you get some idea of the contribution that these monks and nuns of the early Middle Ages made.
And for this reason, we're just as likely to find manuscript sources outside of Ireland. And scholars have been able to identify possible traces of early Irish chant in two antiphons found in a manuscript from Normandy, one being the Ibbunt Sancti.
This is a unicum. It's preserved only with music in the Paris Arsenal manuscript 279. This is a breviary from Cain. And we know that in the life of St. Columbanus by his biographer called Jonas, he states in it that when St. Columbanus was dying, the monks on his deathbed, after he received the last sacraments, they sang Ibbunt Sancti. So this is recorded that they sang this at his deathbed. And we find this chant with music in this 13th century breviary from Normandy.
Alleluia.
the other chant, which also happens to be in this manuscript, is the Crucem Sanctam. And this also bears characteristics or hallmarks of possibly an Irish chant. It has the same cellular motific structure as well. So these two have been identified as, for quite a while now, as representative possibly. And so they're like little gems in the notated sources.
Chant developed into ever more elaborate structures, beginning with a simple melody and later incorporating rhythm and counter melody, there was a corresponding need to develop the ways in which it was written. Professor Eleanor Giro is the course director in ritual chant and song at the Irish World Academy.
Within monastic and cathedral contexts, there would have been the whole community would have sung in the choir. But there were certain portions of the chant that would have been sung by a single person. For example, every piece of chant would have started off with one person singing the first couple of words, and they would have then sort of set the pitch and set the tempo. Because if you try to get everybody to try and start at the same time, you don't know what note you're coming in on, you don't know how fast to go. So one person starts off and then everybody joins in when it's clear. And what's interesting is it's the passages that would have been sung solo that are getting set polyphonically, that are getting these extra improvised or composed voices added to them. So the incipit, that those first few words that would have been sung by a soloist, they get set polyphonically. And then the section in which the choir comes in, that's just sung monophonically. And then you get to the middle section, which would have been sung by a soloist, and that's where we find polyphony being added. So it's the trained singers that are singing the polyphony in the Notre Dame School and in the Winchester Troper and elsewhere. And then it's the sections that would have been sung by the whole community, they remain as monophonic chant.
Polyphonic chant is where you have more than one voice singing at the same time. And usually, these voices work independently of one another.
Poly is from the Latin for many, and phon meaning sounds. So polyphonic music literally means that there are many sounds. And when we're using this to describe early music, it's often referring to music which is for two or more voices. So you'd say monophonic, one sound, for chant, where everyone is singing the same thing at the same time. And then polyphonic, if you have two or more people or two or more groups of people singing different melodies at the same time, which work together.
And spearheading these innovations was the Notre Dame School in Paris, with composers like Léonine and Perrotin.
There are a number of characteristics which are important in music and musical notation that emerge in the Notre Dame School. The Notre Dame School is probably the first place where we have music being written for more than two voices, for three or four voices. So when you have three or four people singing together, you need to start being able to regulate the rhythm of the music. Because if you've got two people, you can kind of work together and move along. But when you have three people, you start to need to be able to regulate who sings what when. So along with the Notre Dame School, we see the emergence of a way of notating rhythm, which didn't exist before. So so that's in the 13th century. Our sources date from about the 1240s onwards, and they are the earliest examples in which rhythm is notated in music.
We're listening to the Hilliard Ensemble with a traditional Gregorian chant, Viderunt Omnes, that Perrotin expanded into early polyphony.
There wasn't this kind of notion of a composer being somebody who dictated what music was. Instead, music making happened by the performers, the people who were singing chant and singing polyphony were creating it and working with changing it, partly in real time probably as they were going along, but as the music got more and more complex, it probably would have required a degree of rehearsal.
A particularly revealing source of Irish medieval chant is the Dublin Troper.
This is a book that most likely was associated with St. Patrick's Cathedral and probably Christchurch Cathedral in Dublin in the middle medieval period. And it has some really fascinating pieces of music called sequences.
These are poetic pieces meant for inclusion in the Mass and could be dedicated to Mary or the saints. There are two in the Dublin Troper related to St. Patrick that reference what we would now call the folklore surrounding Ireland's patron saint.
Here is another great example of this kind of coexistence. One of the things that is really interesting about the Irish material is that it was very fluent in the musical language of continental Europe and European Christianity, but with a distinctive... It wasn't afraid to keep aspects of the Irish tradition. So one of the sequences to Patrick, for example, uses a very, very well-known tune. It was associated with a Christmas text, and it was known right throughout. We have it in manuscripts right throughout Europe, but it's the only place we have it used with a text to Patrick. So it used this really popular, almost like a pop song from Christmas, takes that tune, but very likely wrote new words, probably in Ireland, probably in Dublin, to Patrick. So you have this really interesting, and the text around Patrick then has all of these wonderful allusions to the traditions of miracles. The miracles of saints form a lot of the material we have from the early Irish manuscripts about the lives of saints. So in this little sequence we have, for example, the miracle when Patrick changed water into honey, or when he made ice into fire. Or there's a great story about Patrick. Somebody steals a goat and everybody's saying, "Where's the goat? Who's stolen the goat?" And Patrick says to the goat, "Come forth and tell us where you are." And of course, the thief has eaten the goat. So the goat bleats from the thief's belly and everybody knows who the thief is. So all of these are alluded to in this liturgical chant. So it's a really, I think it's a wonderful example of this connection between a very profound and assimilated sense of the wider world of Western Christianity, but a determination to continue to reference a distinctive Irish heritage.
Group Cantarelle are part of a movement in recent years that's seen chant move out of the monastery to the performance stage.
What I found was that the sonic seed of chant in its most alive form had become separated from monastic tradition. That where you were finding, this is really interesting, I think, where you were finding the, if you wish, the spirit as manifest in this sonic expression, you were finding it in secular downtown society. And it was in the hands of mainly professional early music singers who were astonished and fascinated and passionate about the music itself.
Anna Fahy leading the choral group Shiona into a Kyrie eleison composed by yours truly. This is the piece I mentioned earlier that first served to spark my interest into cantarelle and the story of Irish medieval chant. But what of the place of chant today and into the future? Micheál had some interesting thoughts.
I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, I can't prove any of this, but sure, look, most of the things of life that are important, you don't need to prove, you know they're there. So here I am, I said, so you have this 2,000-year tradition. It hasn't died, but it has moved out of the monastery. It's moved out of its faith context, which is really interesting because it asks the question, it begs the question as to whether there is something within the chant itself which is a codification of something. I think there is myself. And people can talk about post-religious society. I don't believe in it for a minute. It's just simply shifting and changing. That's all that's happening. Mind you, that's all. It's a big thing to happen. It's seismic. But the ultimate desire, that hasn't gone away. It's actually only increased because of the crutches that people leaned on have been taken away. So you either fall on your face or you find some other way of standing up. Why should the energy which created the tradition itself, why should it stop? Why should it be satisfied and happy with what's actually there? Is it possible to actually generate new repertoire? And should that new repertoire be generated in languages other than Latin? And what does that actually mean? And what does that mean in terms of how all of that fits into liturgy and new forms of religious thinking, ideology and thought? So there you go, from the so-called very simple chant melody into something decidedly cosmological. It's a good story.